Hello and welcome to Vox Talks, a series of audio interviews with leading economists from around the world. I'm Viv Davis from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. It's the 25th of February 2011 and I'm speaking to Professor Albert Marcet of the London School of Economics about why he considers recent predictions by the media and many economists of possible Spanish sovereign default are misguided. Professor Marcet discusses his view of Spain's fiscal sustainability, its unemployment and housing problems, and the recapitalisation of the Cajas. He also discusses debt and fiscal coordination in the Eurozone. I began the interview by asking Professor Marcet to explain why he was of the opinion that much of what is currently written about Spain falls a long way short of the real picture.
There's been a lot of confusion about how bad the situation is in Spain in the last year or since April or May, and that certainly in the Spanish economy there are some challenges, but I don't see how they are bigger than the challenges of almost any European Union country. I think Spain is pretty average, and that the price of CDSs, the sovereign spread, seem to indicate a danger which I just don't see. I mean, there's a number of problems that have been pointed out. So over the course of the last year, the story has been changing. No, first it was a fiscal policy was supposed to be unsustainable. Then it was social security. Then it was the deficit. Then it was regional governments. Then now it's the private banks. So all of these are issues. But I just don't see how they are worse than in many other European countries. And obviously, Spain's debt is one of the lowest. Yes, the deficit was very high in 2009, but it's coming down very quickly, the government deficit. The autonomous regions, some of them have had a large deficit, but have to realize, first of all, the autonomous regions, their total debt is 10% of GDP. 10% of GDP, that's what it is. The other issue with Spanish autonomies is that they cannot issue debt unless the central government allows them. So it's legally is much easier for a Spanish government to control a regional entity that's not working, that has spending too much. While in the US, I don't know, let's talk about California, our states are much harder to control from, basically impossible to control from the central government. Sure, there are issues, but I don't see how they are worse than in many other countries.
What about unemployment? I think no one can deny that severe unemployment is a major problem and concern in Spain. What's your view on what Spain should be doing about its unemployment situation?
So unemployment is no doubt a very bad situation. 20% of unemployment. For example, Andalusia, which is a very large region, has 30% unemployment. That's certainly a concern, and there's certainly policies that could be improved that would lower unemployment. Unemployment compensation could and should be given in much more conditional. You know, right now there's almost no monitoring people who get the unemployment compensation. Unemployment compensation should be for those who have been unlucky and are without a job, not for other people. And there's a very little monitoring of that. But the issue is, do we get from that 20% the idea that default is almost imminent? Well, one feature of Spanish unemployment that is fairly well known is that there is this dual market. There's a very large part of the jobs that are with 6 month long contracts, which are very easy to stop. They're not costly to stop.
So temporary short-term contracts.
So the severance pay is very low. They can be simply discontinued. Because of that, which adds flexibility to the economy, okay? From a macroeconomic point of view, you would expect unemployment to go way up during a crisis just because you have this large flexibility, just as you expect it to grow very quickly when things are doing well, because it is the existence of these contracts makes it easier to start growing quickly when things are going well. But it is well known that most very, very disproportionate part of the recently unemployed are coming from these 6 month contracts. So it's not good, especially if you are in that sector of the population. It's not a good situation, this dual market, okay? But it doesn't signal any immediate default. Another thing, another very simple calculation that I made in this note is just to look at hours worked, no? Because for output, employment doesn't matter. What matters is how many hours are worked. Consciously or unconsciously, what other countries are doing is they are hiding better their unemployment. They, They are retiring people much earlier. The welfare state is very different across countries. And so the way in which unemployment is hidden in each country is very different. In some cases, it's hidden through very early retirement. In some countries, it's hidden through a huge part of the population with part-time, not temporary, but part-time contracts. But in any case, if you count hours worked in Spain, it comes out more or less like many other countries. There's been a dip in 2009, but Spain doesn't come so badly off in terms of hours worked, which is what counts for output and for tax revenue and for this kind of thing.
And Zapatero has recently increased the retirement age, I believe.
I would say that for a European country, the political system is fairly aware of what it should be doing. We always complain about politicians, and we should. But now there was a change in the retirement age from 65 to 67. I don't know, in France, they changed it from 60 to 62, and it was a much bigger deal. So there's a lot of room for improvement, but there is a, you know, the way the government, the central government and the regional governments are reducing the deficit rapidly is a sign that some things are working well and that there is a certain reputation for doing things well. And then the other thing that kind of relates perhaps more to my previous work is the fact that Spain was running a surplus or a very small deficit during the 2000s. Now that tells me that there is a system of subsidies, spending, taxes. The whole system is much better balanced, actually, than, for example, the UK, which was growing also, but having very large, much larger deficit during the 2000s. So I think in the UK, we have seen a much stronger cutback, I think, in the last 2 years, both in the last year of the Labour government and obviously with the new government. The whole package, everything that has been done to increase taxes and lower spending is much more drastic than what has been done in Spain. And I think it has to be because in the last 10 years here there had been a history of higher deficits. So I'm much less worried than many people seem to be. You know?
You mentioned just a little earlier the autonomous regions in Spain, of which there are 17, I believe, 13 of which underwent elections this year. Such a composition must be a real challenge of coordination for the government in terms of meeting its budget and austerity targets. Would you agree with that?
Sure, but there's several things there. One is that some of the revenue, a big part of the revenue of these regions comes from very volatile taxes. Like in Spain, there is a tax on real estate transactions. It's like a Tobin tax. It's like 7% of real estate transaction is taxed, just the whole state. I can imagine that this is incredibly volatile. So it's normal, given this tax, that these regions, for example, experience a bigger deficit when things are going badly. From a fiscal point of view, it's not a bad thing that this tax is there, because then other times it compensates. So these big deficits of the last few years, yeah, they are something that has to be looked into, because it's been probably too much generosity in some social programs or something. But in part it's built in the system, and it should reverse when things start going well, which they will. But also, there's this issue that autonomous regions cannot are very limited in their ability to issue debt. They can issue debt, but if they go above, if they go above 1.5% of the GDP of the region, they need permission from the government to issue debt. Therefore, they'll have to. They are basically forced to cut down. Obviously, it's not as easy as this. Some regions may resist, but the tools for coordination are there, and they are much, much stricter, for example, than the Growth and Stability Pact. I mean, the Growth and Stability Pact, I guess it still is valid, no? So if you go above 3%, they send you a letter, but you still keep issuing debt, no? If a country exceeds 3%, the enforcement of the 3% in the Growth and Stability Pact is basically non-existent, as we have seen what happened. The enforcement mechanism within Spanish regions is much stronger. So we'll see what happens. It'll be interesting to see what happens, but the details are very different.
You're starting to touch on what I was going to ask you next, which is, if we scale this up, I believe some of your work recently has been on fiscal coordination within the Eurozone.
So I've done some work on optimal, on fiscal policy when governments cannot insure, so that basically if there is a shock, you have to issue debt and you have to try to repay the debt in good times and issue debt in bad times. Now, if you look at government debt in that way, no, you look at government debt as a buffer stock, which is a good idea to use. If we're in a recession, why should we close the hospitals and the schools? No, it's better to issue debt. So debt is a buffer stock. You should use it. It should be there. But the issue is, if you allow governments to use it as you should, as a buffer, then how do you distinguish from between a government that's properly using debt as a buffer from a government that's just running an unsustainable fiscal policy?
Is there a good level of debt that a government could hold?
There are good ways of adjusting to debt, which are not built in the way automatic stabilizers are being set up. And it's not built in the way that we economists usually try to ascertain fiscal sustainability. So we usually think of measuring fiscal sustainability by looking at the discounted sum, by a present value calculation, a permanent income hypothesis kind of calculation. We try to see if the discounted sum of surpluses discounted at the appropriate interest rate is consistent with the current level of debt, given that the current level of debt should be this discounted, be equal to this discounted sum of surpluses, right? So that's true, that's something you should look at, but it's not nearly enough, because when you have fluctuations in the economy and you have debt that's being used as a buffer stock, something that a sustainable fiscal policy should have is that it should respond to debt. So, you know, it has to be that taxes or unemployment subsidy or government spending, it has to be contingent on debt. And in practice, it is, no? I mean, what we see is that when debt goes out of hand, then governments start drastically cutting. That is a bit of a dangerous way of doing it, because then you have a crisis, then things are done in a hurry. What should be the case is that this dependence on debt is built in the automatic stabilizers. I mean, it should be the case that unemployment compensation is linked to debt. And it should be the case that civil servants' wages is linked to debt. Because in the end it is, no? In the end it is. Now in Spain, the wage of civil servants was cut about 5%. Because debt and deficit were too high. Well, it was cut in 5% last year, but the year before it went up by 3%. In 2009, it went up by 3%. Maybe if we would have had an automatic way of adjusting, for example, civil servant wages to the level of debt, these things would be much more humane and would affect everybody in a much more smoother way. It would be clear that the fiscal policy is sustainable. It would be clear that something will be done when that gets out of hand. So I think that should be a part of the system in Europe, no? That there should be a clear statement by the individual countries that their automatic stabilizers will, and their expenses and their budget will adjust that before it gets out of hand.
Coming back to Spain for a moment, the country is currently undergoing a rapid and substantial recapitalization of its troubled cajas, or savings banks, in an effort to restore international confidence. Are you confident that the recapitalization process will succeed in enabling the cajas to raise long-term money on the finance markets?
I'm confident that it can be done in a way that nothing major will happen. I mean, I'm not an expert in banking, but it's obvious that in one big difference between Spain and many other countries is that it is the smaller banks that are in trouble. The big banks are fine, pretty much. And these small institutions, they can be made to adjust in many, many ways. They can be absorbed, you know, they could simply sell off their assets and disappear and sell the client list.
A lot of them have merged, actually.
It's some of what's been doing with some success. Some cases there's been a merger of two bad institutions, which is not a good idea because then you have one bad institution. But most of the mergers have been done quite reasonably. And so there is that possibility. It will depend on the political will and it will depend on many things, whether it's done successfully. But there is room for maneuver. But there's lots of other countries that have big problems in Europe, have big problems with various aspects of their banks system. No, there's lots. But I guess compared with the US, what happened is in the US there was a very quickly, in this recession, big losses that were realized very quickly throughout the banking system. And the losses are being realized very slowly in Europe. We're still waiting to see what will happen with the Spanish housing boom. We're still waiting to see what will happen with Greek debt, Irish debt. These things are still looming, and I'm sure Spanish banks, but also many other banks, will find that they have to realize some losses in the next few years. And these problems that we have now with the Cajas, similar problems will appear in other parts of the European banking system. And there's no reason that this will be the end of anything. We've had banking crises before. We have these challenges. We have many tools to deal with them.
So, in your opinion, despite the fact that Spain is sitting on around 1.5 million homes that are yet to be sold, it's not another island and heading for a sort of Irish-style meltdown?
I think pretty much people agree that it's not heading for that. That there is a hole, no? But the size of the hole is relatively much lower, and that there's much more room for maneuver. Yes, the stock of housing is a problem because, again, we still don't know who will realize the losses. The construction sector is, which used to be huge and that was bad, is now under its normal level, and, well, it's also a sector that provides employment. So until these houses are all finished and lost and sold, there's very little demand for a new construction activity. So yeah, it's a problem, but I don't think it is nearly the problem as in Ireland. I think pretty much people agree on it.
Do you think the future for Spain is best in the euro, or do you think there's a case for being independent and outside of the eurozone?
Oh, I have no doubt that it's much better to stay in the euro. I mean, you hear a lot of people saying, well, it's a problem because now we cannot devalue. And my opinion is, thank God we cannot devalue. And now we will really have to face the problem of why we got into this very big deficit in 2009. And we had to, fiscal authorities had to respond and to be clear to the voters and to the public about what had been done that was not right, how it had to be reversed. And it's not going to be these guys with a devaluation. No. Another problem with a devaluation is that, I hear American economists talking about devaluations as if they are, some American economists, as if devaluations are such a great thing, and they probably never lived through a country that had a huge devaluation. I mean, what happens when you have a big devaluation is that it's very difficult to be competitive in high-skilled technology, because to export high-skilled technology, you need to import high-skilled technology, and you cannot do it if you just, you know, a devaluation makes you competitive in low-skilled labor products, and okay, if that's what we're going to do, then the future is not too bright, no? The future lies in being competitive in a bunch of industries that are now developing in Spain, and for that we need that a devaluation doesn't occur.
And more broadly, are you optimistic that the eurozone will ride through the crisis and that the European Financial Stability Facility will be successful in preventing future bailouts and potential defaults of peripheral countries?
I think it could. So the Europeans move very slowly, you know. Yeah, it has to be, given the way the European Union is organized. But so far it has moved. Mm-hmm. So far it has reacted to the challenges ahead. It has created the facility. It has responded to the problems that were coming out. So I have faith that in the end, the people will agree to doing the right thing. Will the euro go through this? Well, it depends on the euro staying popular in a few countries. But I think, you know, Germany, France will realize that their future also lies in the euro. And it's very difficult for Germany to be such a leader in technology, in high-quality cars, high-quality manufacturing, if it doesn't have a stable, if it's not in a broad area with a monetary union. Small countries, for small countries to be leaders in technology, if they are subject to huge shocks to the exchange rate. So I think Germany has benefited and will benefit.
And one of the things that you've just taken on, in fact, Albert, is the chair of the Euro Area Business Cycle Network.
Yeah.
How do you see your work on business cycles fitting into your research on fiscal policy in Europe generally and what happens with the business cycle?
Yeah. No, I think that a lot of work that's been done is actually very relevant, and it's a bit frustrating sometimes sometimes to see that so little of the actual policy discussion in Europe is relying on, let's say, serious economic thinking. There's many very good economists in Europe who have been thinking about issues like fiscal policy sustainability, who were criticizing the Growth and Stability Pact for a long time, because the question was what will happen at the first crisis, no, with this pact. And I guess, again, because the policy discussions in Europe are so politicized by the discussion of what's good for each individual country, there's then little room, perhaps, for thinking about what should be done, and it's much more of a political compromise. But I would hope that all this work that's being done on fiscal policy, on how to facilitate the adjustment of different countries after the recession, that it would help in designing better policies. I think we have done a lot of progress, and if the purely political discussion would leave room for it, there's a lot of interesting things to be said on how to design better fiscal policy coordination.
Albert Marcet, thanks very much for talking to us today.
Thanks, Albert.